You've just landed inside Launch Street, the innovation podcast, where we interview top innovators out there shaking things up so you can innovate and differentiate and get further faster in this crazy cluttered world. And now, innovation thought leader and your super fly host, Tamara Kleinberg.
Grab your coffee, Launch Streeters, because I have an interview for you today. Have you ever noticed how some entrepreneurs or intrapreneurs move seamlessly from in the trenches to a leadership role while others fall on their face? I've seen it time and time again, and I've always wondered why some make it and some don't. Well, frankly, I don't want to get in my own way as Launch Street grows, so this is actually kind of a deep concern of mine. So our guest, Les Trockman, is what I would call a master entrepreneur. And we dig deep into that, the difference between founders and CEOs, the difference in skills, attitudes, and abilities, and how to not be your own worst enemy. Get out of your own way. So Les is the CEO of the Trockman Group, focused on helping companies grow and scale, as well as managing director and majority investor in PureView, an early stage company focused on disrupting the medical imaging business. He's got a lot of experience to pull from, and he's here sharing it with us on Launch Street. And of course, once you listen, go to the show notes for this podcast and download one of our Launch Streeters' favorite secret sauce tools, how to get buy-in on your ideas. If you want to build a business, you've got to learn how to communicate all of those innovative ideas, and this video will help you do that. Now, on to the interview. Well, I am so excited for this conversation. Les, thank you for joining me today.
My pleasure.
So I want to start with asking you, because I think you have a really unique expertise. How did you get into this arena of, you know, going from founder to CEO and that kind of transition and scaling and growing businesses? How did you become an expert in that?
I became an expert the hard way by doing it and getting it wrong.
It's always a good way to start.
I was invited to become a CEO of a small company about 20 years ago, a little bit more than that. And I relished the idea of being a CEO, took it over from a founder, and began my career as a founder successor or second CEO. And again, had some bumps and bruises along the way, a few successes, and I'm still here living to talk about it.
So I'm just curious, out of the gate, looking back, what is one of the biggest bumps and bruises that you got?
Probably the biggest bump and bruise you can get is getting fired. I've been fired twice in this role, and the first time I got fired, I thought it was the end of my career. I thought I had failed, and it wasn't until a little bit later, like 24 hours later, that I realized that when you put yourself on the line to install change in an organization, potentially the person who you are changing from might not like that.
And I'm assuming it's fair to say that that transition point from founder startup to having more of a business with a CEO is a huge change point.
It is. It's an enormous change point. It's probably the biggest change that any founder could ever go through. It's kind of like, and I hate to use this analogy, but it's really true. It's kind of like giving up your child for adoption. You are handing off your baby to somebody else to raise it.
So let me ask you this about it, because I think a lot of our listeners on Launch Street, and I know I've been through this, and you know, you and I were talking offline about my husband and his work, and it is one of those things where, you know, as the entrepreneur, you have all this drive and all this passion to build this business, but at some point, and maybe I'm saying this wrong, you get in the way or it grows past you. So my first question is, how do we know as entrepreneurs or founders when we get to that transition point where it's time to be a CEO or get a CEO?
Yeah. So it comes up in a couple of different ways, but it typically happens when you are running so fast as an entrepreneur, as a founder, that you can't keep up. And what I mean by that is you realize that as a doer, which we all start out as doers when we found companies, as a doer, you're not making as big a difference as you'd like to in your company. There are more people in the company. They need help in terms of management. And there are other functions that are not getting done because you don't have the time to do them. And that's when you realize, okay, I've got to change. I'm no longer the individual contributor that I once was. Now I've got to take on some new skills.
And are those? Do you think that those are skills that we have and need to engage? Are they skills we need to learn? Are there skills we need to bring somebody else in for?
Could be all of the above. We've got some success stories, and most people, when they look at founders, they have this starry-eyed view of who they are. And that's because they know the ones who are superstars. They know the Bill Gateses, the Michael Dells, and others who have made it. And those folks actually learned on the job, and they were able to scale themselves. But most of us mere mortal human beings, we don't have those kind of skills. So we either have to learn very, very quickly, or we have to find somebody else to do it for us.
Do you find that hard too? Because, you know, I know as a small business owner, you know, I know that I don't know everything on one hand, or can't do everything. On the other hand, I'm like, oh my gosh, you want me to get out of the way of my own business? Oh my, it's such a mind mess with you, you know?
It is. And I think what I found with founders who actually have scalable capabilities, they typically are the ones who say out loud often, I actually don't know how to do this. And when you finally admit that you don't know how to do it, then you've got the opportunity to learn. It's the ones who think they know everything that probably don't, that are the ones that are in trouble.
Got it. So you can transition, but it's not maybe for us mere mortals the easiest things to do. What do you think, though, is the biggest difference between maybe what you're capable of or how you act as a founder versus what a CEO or even maybe even a president might bring to the table?
Yeah, so we have this analogy that we use, which is the founder value ladder. And that's that you have to begin to climb that ladder. If you're truly going to move from being just a founder, which is a pretty magical thing to do, so I'm not degrading founders, but if you're going to grow up that ladder and become a true CEO, you've got to go from being an individual contributor to a manager, to a strategist, to an architect, and then potentially to an investor. And I don't mean an investor in other companies, but you've got to begin to think about allocating resources. And those are very different levels than most people are used to when they found a company.
That's so interesting. You know, it's funny. It reminds me of when I used to run this consulting firm. I was a VP. And I used to think as we grew, some people could stay with us and some people really weren't right anymore. And I used to think of it as people who are A players at one level on your team aren't necessarily A players at the next level. They tend to be B players there. That's not where they play well. You got to bring in some new people. Some people move forward, but I'd never really thought about it from maybe it's selfish on my part. I never really thought about it from the founder leadership level, which is what I hear you saying.
Yeah. So that's the place that we find most founders get stuck.
Yeah.
And it's the people issues associated with it. So think about it. When you're a founder, you start up, you're in a battle. You're in the trenches. You're usually competing against very well-heeled competitors doing things a little bit differently than you're doing them. And so the people that are in the foxholes with you become a very loyal bunch, and you become very loyal to them. And when your company grows and scales, you look at those people and you look at them as the loyal friends that they were to you.
Yeah.
Very hard to part with them, even if they're not the right people for the next level.
Yeah. And you have to look at yourself, I guess, right? And ask that same question of, am I the right leader for the next level, or do I have a different role to play?
You do. And that's a really hard thing to do. We tend to use the analogy, and this sometimes helps founders understand this. But look at yourself objectively and say, if you had a boss today, would they hire you as the optimal person to do your job as CEO?
That's probably a no. This feels very humbling, Les, I have to admit. I'm like, oh no, I might need to bring somebody in. So you wrote the book, Don't F It Up. I love the name, by the way. How founders and their successors can avoid the cliches that inhibit growth. So in your experience, and we've been talking a little bit about this, but maybe from the book too, what are some of those ways that we as the founders, you know, become our own worst enemies as the business grows and scales?
Yeah. So the title is very important. So the Don't F It Up part of it is, that's in fact what a founder said to me when I took over the role from him. This was a couple of hundred.
That's motivational.
Well, this is a couple of $100 million company. And he said it to me, and he was a good friend of mine. And I understood what he was saying. But underlying that is don't take undue risks. Don't try things that might fail. Don't do those. And that's exactly the opposite of what you really want to instill in your employees, right? You want them to take calculated risks, but take those risks. And even if they fail, that's okay. But founders, because they've been through this uphill battle, they get a little gun shy about allowing somebody else who might not do as well as they did to take those kind of risks.
So does that really then inhibit the growth? Because ultimately you're put in a catch-22, aren't you? If you're now the CEO or the moving into the president role, if you're told, okay, don't do what I did that actually made this company successful, please don't do anything actually, because it might hurt the company.
So you hit the nail on the head. And that's probably the reason why twice I failed at doing this, because I tried to do things that needed to be done, but they were a little too risky for the founder, at least their appetite at that time. But that's exactly right. So you're asking somebody to come into the job that you had where you risked it all to start this company, and you're saying, but don't do that anymore. And we've got a long list of companies that have actually abided by that, right? So you got the Kodaks of the world who stopped innovating, or at least they stopped listening to their innovators. That really hindered their ability to take it to the next step. And then you've got the Netflixes of the world who got laughed at Blockbuster because Blockbuster said, hey, we're not going to do that. So it's that lack of willingness to take risks or to truly innovate that can kill anybody.
You know, I just, for launch readers out there listening, I want you as entrepreneurs and founders to just take a pause and a deep breath, because Les, what I'm hearing you say is actually gives me a bit of a sense of relief, which is, okay, I've risked it all. I'm the founder. I'm in the trenches. I am good here. I'm really good here. But wow, it gives me a little bit of a sense of a relief to know that when it gets bigger and a little bit out of my realm and to the place where, frankly, I don't want to manage day to day. I want to be the creator. That's what I'm good at. That I can actually bring somebody else in to do that.
You know, that's a really important point. So what we try to do is get founders to realize it's not because they're bad that they can't get to the next level. It's because they're good that they can't get to the next level. It's a very different challenge. The role of being a CEO of a scalable or a scaling company is way more mundane than the role of being a founder. It's not as much fun. And so it is not necessarily a game that everybody should play.
So let's talk a little bit about scaling, because I think, you know, for many businesses out there, one of the biggest bottlenecks that I often see, if particularly with, you know, more innovative companies that are trying to shake things up, is the ability to scale and grow. So, and I know that your company focuses on helping companies do just that. So if I'm in the early stage, what are the things that I need to absolutely make sure I'm doing, putting in place, maybe even thinking about so that I can actually scale the business?
Yeah. So this is where we all get into ruts. So we do something really hard, start a business, and we figured out how we got successful, and we keep doing that, which is what human beings do. We like that success. We crave that. The problem with that is everything around us is changing. And so in order to scale, what you have to get in the habit of doing is questioning everything all the time. And in fact, I worked in a pretty big company, and I started questioning everything, asking why we did certain things. And I found deep down in the bowels of the company that we had somebody in order entry that with a highlighter went through every line item of every contract that we had to make sure that it was correct. And she was going through 20 or 30 highlighters a year doing this. And I said, why are we doing this? She said, well, because the salespeople sometimes make mistakes. And I said, well, why don't we fix that as opposed to having you go through every one of these line items of the hundreds of contracts that we had? But it's the way we did things, and nobody questioned that.
So will you give us some advice on Launch Street on how to ask the right questions? Because I think, you know, I loved your example just now with the highlighters, and all I'm thinking is I need to go to Costco and buy like a package of highlighters. But, you know, it's very easy to look at that. Let's just stay on your example and say, oh, okay, we need a box of highlighters and she needs better lighting and we just need a better system to get her contracts faster. Where with what you did was really actually think differently about the situation and say, how do we make the entire thing more efficient and better? So how do you do, can you give us some examples or some advice? How do you do that?
I think it's as simple as asking the underlying why question. And you know, there's an author that got very rich on doing the start with why as a question. And it's because it's really, really relevant. It's when we stop asking those questions that we lose out. So I had a situation where I went into a meeting with a bunch of people in a company that was well established. I was the new CEO, went in, and they brought in these reams of paper, colorful documents, 30 pages long, hand it to everybody, and everybody's in the meeting nodding their heads. And they were talking about, I think this was a professional services metric. And in the midst of all this, because I was okay with being naive and okay with not knowing the answers, I asked the question of whether this report indicated that things were going well or they were going poorly. And in unison, two different people in the meeting, one answered yes and one answered no. And so I knew there was a problem. But it's that willingness to be naive. I call it the Columbo approach, and I'm old enough to remember Columbo on TV, but he was that bumbling detective who had this very unassuming look. And he would ask questions that nobody else would ask. And he was able to get to the root of the crime by doing that. And it's the very same thing that you need to do in a company, is you just need to be willing to ask those naive questions, and you'd be surprised sometimes what answers you get.
And do you think, as you know, whether it's a founder or really CEO at this point, that it is still your job to be the one digging deep across all those things? Because, you know, in my head, I battle with dig and ask these questions and, hey, don't get too far in the trenches anymore. Don't be a micromanager. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think there's a difference between being a micromanager and asking people to think. And yeah. So it may not be the founder or it may not be the CEO's job, but you need to instill in your company the fact that it's okay to ask those kind of questions. And it's okay to even turn up issues that are wrong. And it's okay to fail at trying new things. If you instill that as a culture in your company, then it's not you doing it every day. And when that happens, then the flywheel starts turning and you start making progress.
Asking people to think. What a great shift on asking questions. I love that, because that is the culture that we want. To your point about scaling and that being about constantly asking questions and making things, you know, better and improving, people need to think in order to do that.
They do. And you as a CEO or as a founder that's scaling into a CEO, you need to think about how do you step back and give your staff, your team, something that we call the commander's intent, which is a term that the military has used for a long time, but the instill in them the idea that this is the direction that I want to go, but you have the right and responsibility to make decisions as to how to get there. In military parlance, we always say that no strategy survives encounter with the enemy, and that's what you have to remember as a CEO or as a founder scaling to be a CEO. Because your people are going to get stuck without you there, and they're going to have to make some decisions, and you want them to be able to do that.
Well, I would hope that, you know, my goal anyway as an entrepreneur is to have a business that runs without me. Because if I have to be there to make the money, then I can't scale. Yes. So, you know, there's this catch-22 of like, it needs me, but it really shouldn't need me. People need to be able to do their jobs when I'm not in the building.
They do. And I think one of the ways you measure yourself as whether you're able to scale is how much are you really needed on a day-to-day basis. Mm. We encourage founders to take vacations to places that don't have good cell service and then, you know, come back and see what happens.
What's really hard is going without your laptop and then realizing everything happened without me. Nothing went horribly wrong. Oh no!
We've had I have a guy who's now a good friend of mine, a founder, a very good founder, and a very good CEO ultimately. But in his first endeavor, he couldn't figure out how to detach himself from the company. He was scared to death to take a vacation, and his wife badgered him to take a vacation. And ultimately, it was about a 15-person company. He actually took the whole company on vacation with him because he couldn't bear to leave him.
I don't know. I think if that were my husband, I'd be like, no, not going to happen. I want my alone time. You know, but this is really great advice. And what you're saying about no plan survives the field, or however you said it. Muhammad Ali has one of my favorite quotes, which is, everybody has a plan until you get punched in the face.
That's exactly.
Sorry, it's not Ali. I think that was actually Tyson, Mike Tyson. I might be getting my boxers wrong. But it's the same thing of like, hey, things never go as they are planned, right?
They don't. And with technology today, we get in the habit of thinking we can control everything no matter what. But we have, and I wrote in my book, there's a great analogy of this commander's intent, of this idea of you're not going to be there, so you better give a really clear message. And that was it at the Gettysburg battle, where there was some very clear distinctions given to one side versus the other. And we think actually that lack of distinction caused a change in the battle at Gettysburg, perhaps changing the entire war, perhaps changing the entire world, all based upon the inability to communicate in real time, so therefore having to give very clear direction.
It just goes to show you how powerful communication is. And I really appreciate what you're saying about commander's intent. So launch treaters out there, you don't even have to be a founder to take that advice about commander's intent and how you communicate with your people. If you lead anybody or you influence up or down, I think you can take that same approach and get a ton of value out of it. So Les, I want to ask you, because you've talked about innovation a couple questions ago, where does innovation fit in today's business environment?
I think innovation is critical, and I don't think that's a trite thing to say. The world is changing very, very quickly today, at least as quickly or more quickly than it ever has. So standing still is no longer an option for any business. You have to figure out how to get ahead of your competition. And if you don't, you will run the risk of being taken over by some other founder who figures it out, who becomes more innovative and a little quicker than you. And eat your lunch.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And thank you for being blunt about it. They will eat your lunch. So, you know, you talked earlier a little bit about innovation, about getting people to think, which I think is a big part of that, because that means you're not just doing what, you know, the A to B to C or what you're told. You're really thinking things through. Are there other things organizations should be thinking about when it comes to innovation and how to actually implement it?
Well, so from an innovation point of view, you have to let people fail. And creating a culture where failure is good, not bad, is really one of the keys that we try to instill in our client companies. So from that point of view, that can't be lip service. So you've got to have a situation where if somebody intelligently tries something and fails, there needs to be a process in place for how they learn from that. We call it an after-action review. That comes from the Air Force. So we've got a lot of military analogies that we do. But you've got to learn from it. But in fact, the company or the organization as a whole has to be willing to celebrate failure as a step closer to what that next innovation is going to be.
So let me ask you a question about that, because I agree with you wholeheartedly. And I hear that from leaders in organizations of all sizes, you know, tiny to the, you know, Fortune 500, Fortune 100. But I think that there's a fundamental challenge in implementing that, because at the end of the day, right, there are money, resources, promotions, et cetera, on the line. So how do you get them over that hurdle? Because it, to me, it's one of those things that I totally agree with. And when they get it, it just, it works. I know it works, but it's hard to do.
It's very hard to do. And it is one of those things that has to come from the top. Because if people don't think that the ultimate boss is bought into it, they're going to hide from it no matter what they do. So we try to encourage people to have a little fun with this and come up with rituals for celebrating failures. And we all do a pretty good job these days in celebrating success in companies. We have our little company outings. We have our little company get-togethers and give awards and all kinds of things like that. I encourage people to give awards for people that have failed, taken calculated risks but failed, and then talk about what it meant from a progress point of view with the company. We all remember the allegories, the stories about Thomas Edison, about how many times he failed before he succeeded. And if you can start, again, celebrating that, start getting that mentality throughout your organization, starting at the top, then what you'll find is that people say, I actually am encouraged to take risks. I'm encouraged to try things, and I'm encouraged to learn from my failures.
You know, I should have asked you this question as we dug into this. When you say failure, what is your definition of that? Or what are some examples of things that you would classify in this? Hey, we need to celebrate this. It's a failure, but we need to celebrate. Because I think that word also gets thrown around a lot and everybody has a different definition.
It does. And for me, it's very clear is that the task that you are currently performing did not end up with the intended result. And there are some great stories in corporate America of not ending up with the intended result that ended up being terrific. And you may remember the 3M, the post-it notes idea. So the I think it was a guy in this case who who invented Post-it notes, he actually tried to come up with a glue that was a glue that would stick forever. And in fact, he failed, to use that fail word, drastically, and instead came up with a glue that actually was really easy to peel off anytime and stayed there for a long time. So you could use it over and over again. And that was the history of Post-it notes. So failure is simply not intended outcome, but you never know what you can find from failure.
Do you think that, you know, when you position it as it's an outcome, right? It either worked or didn't work. And, you know, I'm going to learn from it and either adjust or not adjust, depending on the outcome. Do you then remove the word failure, or does that become this false sugar coating of the situation?
Yeah, I'm sort of a mature individual in business. I've been around for a long time. So it's hard for me to take the word failure and call it something else, because I think it's not honest from my point of view. But I think you just have to change the attributes of what happens, what are the consequences of failure, and go from there.
You know, one of the things I've seen, I'm sure you have, is that is oftentimes, as you know, a company goes from entrepreneurial to more established, they tend to lose their ability to innovate, or they get past it because they get so focused on maybe processes. How do our listeners avoid that as they grow and scale?
Well, you've got to actually have processes and procedures to enable, as you grow a company, you're going to have a lot of mere mortal human beings. I used that word before, but you're going to have them in your company. And you've got to build things that will enable them to be successful. But in order to keep innovating, what you have to do is you have to keep telling the story. The story of how your company was founded, for example. How somebody came up with a new approach. How you risked it all to make that happen. And you got to create these allegories that have to keep playing as that record in your company in order for people to get it. I don't think that you want to look to and some companies do this, where they establish a C-level executive who's in charge of innovation.
Yeah.
I think unless it's part of your overall culture, unless everybody in their jobs is encouraged to take those risks, again, calculated risks, learn from failures, or whatever we want to reterm that as, but you got to encourage that to happen throughout the organization. Otherwise, you're going to risk having people wait for the boss to tell them what to do.
So I was going to ask you a little bit of follow-up on that, because I kind of smiled a little bit when you said, you know, they bring in the chief innovation officer, or there's a special team, you know, in the cool office, and they're responsible for innovation. When we do that, what happens?
Well, we say it's not your job, and that's right. And that's the deadly piece.
Right. That's right. So then, just to your point, everybody's waiting for the other people to do it. What is one last piece of advice you'd love to give our listeners about, you know, this transition and how to, as you say, don't F it up?
Yeah, I think the piece of advice that we typically give, and I'll focus this on founders, is that you are great at something, and that great doesn't necessarily have to extend to everything that you do. So find some people that are just as good as you, or perhaps 80% as good as you. And that may be just an ego saying that they can't be as good as you. But find somebody who's almost as good as you at doing the tasks and hand those off. And measure your success by how much you can hand off rather than how much you take on. And if you do that, you'll build yourself at least the beginnings of a muscle to turn yourself into a scalable organization.
Well, I'm going to start measuring myself that way. I'm not sure I'm going to get an A out of the gate. I'm not going to lie. But I like that idea of how much can I hand off. Just a quick follow-up question for you on that. How do I think about hiring then? You know, it's easy to hire people who are like you, right? Because you like them. They're fun. They're sociable. I mean, I know we don't need any more people like me and my team, because we'd never get anything done. It would be ideas. So how do I think about, if I'm that founder, getting those people on board who are, you know, the right people, but different than me, which may be hard?
Yeah. So you do have to get out of that box. Hiring people that are just like you becomes a very homogenous organization. And although that diversity word tends to be an HR term, diversity in thought and diversity in background is really, really important to coming up with innovation. So that's an important piece of it. But the idea that we instill, and actually I use it myself, is I tend to like to hire people that come from a different discipline than I do. So if I'm in the medical imaging business, I like to hire people that come from the record recording business and have them look at my business a little bit differently. What I find is then I don't have them stuck in the same rut. that I'm in. They approach things from a different point of view, and they have, assuming that they're intelligent and have the drive and the desire to get to the next level for themselves, you'll be surprised to find out how much they can bring to the organization and how much energy they have around what they're doing, because they're always learning. And learn in an organization, learning for most people is fun. Learning is invigorating, and learning is where you get your growth.
Different disciplines. I like that. You know, Les, I'd love to ask you kind of as we close up, because you have such an interesting and long background. Is that the right wise
long
background?
Yes.
Wise. When you look at today's marketplace, the just business environment, which industries are you seeing massive change in or just upheaval?
Well, obviously, anything that touches tech is being is really changing today. But I think the biggest innovation that we're seeing altogether, and it's whether you are a tech company yourself or whether you're simply just using tech in your business, which just about everybody is the structural move from computing in your office to computing in the cloud or everywhere, as people like to say. So what we've got now is we've got an environment where you can reach your computing resources from wherever you are. And so companies who are nimble have people in the field, companies who have multiple locations, companies that operate in different geographies, all have the opportunity to share information in a way that's never been done before. And I think what you're seeing now is that's turning everything on its head. And those people who do that best, who have access to that information and who can do something with that information, take actionable action with that information, are the ones that are changing everything. And that goes across the board. I mean, we joke about it, and they're in the news a lot lately, but Uber is one of those companies. That's just a taxi company.
Yeah.
But they've used technology to turn the world on its head.
Well, and they're not even a taxi company at the end of the day, right? They're actually a platform to make those connections.
They are.
And we're taxis. I've always wanted to drive an Uber. I always thought that would be interesting to meet all those people take your Uber.
There are execs who do that just to get to meet people and learn their lessons.
Well, there's a whole value there, isn't it? Which I'm sure we could have a whole nother podcast about is, you know, eat your own dog food, you know, be your customer. Otherwise, you really lose touch with what the marketplace wants from you.
Absolutely.
So this has been great, Les. Where can people go to connect with you, learn more, get your book? And we'll put the links in the show notes.
Yep. The book can be obtained at almost any bookstore or certainly on Amazon. The name of the book is Don't F It Up. And if you just check it for the Don't F, I think you'll find it. They don't like the full name there on Amazon. otherwise, you can find out more about what we do and get access to the book on my website, which is www.foundertransitions.com.
Excellent. Les, thank you so much. This has been fantastic.
Thanks for hanging out with us inside Launch Street. When you're ready to take your game to the next level, join the thousands of others that are upping their innovation edge on GoToLaunchStreet.com, the top online education resource and community platform for innovators looking to use innovation to get measurable results. GoToLaunchStreet.com.